Hello and welcome to Databook, a healthcare analytics news podcast. I'm Jack Murtha.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Castles. If you like Databook, please check us out online at hcanews.com and subscribe, rate, and review.
So today we've got a pretty darn good story and a great guest. He's John Nosta of Nosta Lab, the great health tech thinker. And we're also going to shake things up a bit and try a new episode format. You should let us know what you think of it on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. You can reach us at Healthcare Analytics News or HCA_news.
Today we're bringing you the fascinating story of a group of people who have been very much misunderstood and maligned.
History has indeed treated this group pretty harshly. And you know what? They probably deserve a lot of the hate that's come their way.
But what they definitely don't deserve is this specific rap that they've gotten. The idea that they were backwards, tech-hating, uneducated regressives. Their name has even become a borderline slur.
So who exactly could we be talking about?
We're talking about the Luddites.
That's right. We are not talking about your friend who's still using an iPhone 5. Today, we're bringing you the story of the actual real-life Luddites. Who are these people? Well, they were part of a British movement that existed more than 200 years ago. And they were notoriously known for breaking into mills and smashing to pieces the cutting-edge tech of their time.
And as it turns out, healthcare, and really the whole world, can learn something from the Luddites today. Their 200-year-old lesson resonates in a world where we have physicians writing op-eds, lambasting Med Twitter, and then many others who are starting to get tired of having to fight for the tech that they see as representing progress and improvement in healthcare.
It's true. You see, big-time data breaches and privacy scandals, they've dug up some opposition to data, analytics, social media, and how these tools are being used in healthcare and elsewhere.
There's no doubt that some skepticism is warranted, and that people who are voicing concerns, they all have some valid points, some points that we need to discuss.
But these technological advances are the same ones that are improving outcomes, increasing value, and in general, reshaping healthcare.
And this means that it's up to everyone involved to prevent these modern-day Luddites from reactively breaking the machines that could usher in a new era for healthcare.
The first thing to understand about the Luddites is that you probably don't understand the Luddites.
So take a trip back in time with us to the very early 1800s. We're in the English countryside. It's a time of incredible change and hardship.
Britain is in a war with Napoleon and France, and that seems like it's never going to end. Wages are plummeting, English workers are struggling to put food on the table, and the economy is in really bad shape.
Something huge is going on in the textile industry. Automated machines, the kinds that don't require a human operator, they're starting to enter mills. It's a high-tech step forward, sort of like what we're seeing across most industries today.
And all of these changes hit one group of British workers especially hard. These are the highly skilled artisans who work in textiles. Weavers, croppers, the kind of experts who have a lot of training. The solidly middle class.
For a while, these workers belong to trade unions that are protected by the government. But then in 1799, England passes this law that prohibits that sort of collective bargaining. With that, these textile artisans lose a lot of power.
And at the same time, the influence of French revolutionaries is spreading. So are the writings of Thomas Paine over in the United States. And they're reaching Britain, and they are radicalizing these textile artisans.
And this is when the Luddites are born.
So let's take a step back. The Luddites take their name from a guy supposedly named Ned Ludd. He might be pure fiction, we're not really sure, but the legend is that 30 years earlier, he got so frustrated with his job that he smashed up some manufacturing equipment, and he sort of becomes a folk hero to the Luddites.
But for the first years, the Luddites aren't exactly the Luddites yet. They're still petitioning Parliament for protections. They're rising up bit by bit, taking part in food riots, but they're not really organized as they need to be just yet.
Finally, in 1811, comes the so-called Luddite Explosion. Cloaked textile workers begin mobilizing. They pick up sledgehammers and pistols, and they head over to manufacturing mills in the darkness of night.
These people are warning owners to get rid of the machines and the technology that are becoming so prominent in the textile industry.
And what happens when the owners refuse?
Well, the Luddites drop those sledgehammers and smash the machines.
It's super destructive and scary. But this machine breaking is also what gives rise to perhaps the biggest misconception surrounding the Luddites.
It's not that they're against new tech. Actually, many Luddites manually operate machines in their jobs every day. Rather, the Luddites are against how people are using new automated machines. The Luddites see all these social problems that are making their lives worse as a product of this sort of power and technology.
And in some ways, it's pretty similar to what we're seeing today. Do you see people rallying against health systems that are using data and AI to pinpoint the best therapies for patients? Not really. But plenty of people do seem to be against tech companies and even healthcare companies that are secretly selling their data or using it against them in some way.
That kind of opposition that we're seeing today isn't far off from what drove the Luddites of the 1800s.
But the thing is, the Luddites take it very, very far. Over the next year, the Luddites spread like wildfire across England. They're breaking machines and they're destroying mills. Manufacturers are getting fed up and the government is getting angry.
So in 1812, the government takes action. It sends thousands of troops across the countryside, and leaders even make machine breaking a crime that's punishable by death.
At the same time, the Luddites are getting even more out of control. In January, they burn down a mill in Leeds. In February, they ambush and destroy a shipment of shearing frames headed to a mill near Cleckheaton. Then they organize 13 machine-breaking incidents and armed late-night raids outside of Huddersfield. And then, in early April, they target a mill in Horbury, and the Luddites smash machines with sledgehammers that were made by the very company they were attacking.
All of this chaos eventually comes to a head on Saturday, April 11th, 1812.
On that night, more than 100 Luddites meet at a monument called Dumb Steeple. They're wearing disguises and they're drinking rum for warmth and courage, according to one historian.
The Luddites are also armed with hatchets, pistols, and muskets. They mean business. They develop their plan of attack, and around 11 o'clock, the Luddites begin marching.
They are marching to Rawfold's Mill. It's owned by a guy named William Cartwright, and he has turned this building into a virtual fortress. I quoted that. So he's got militiamen, soldiers, employees, and they're all armed and ready to fight.
So when the Luddites approach the mill, they immediately begin firing. They're trying to disorient their opponents. But Cartwright springs into action and rings a bell that alerts his men that, hey, the Luddites are here.
So the Luddites are shooting at the soldiers and they are trying to bust their way into the mill. But the doors just won't give. Nothing will give.
All the while, Cartwright's men are shooting down on the invaders. This exchange of gunfire goes on for about 20 agonizing minutes.
About then, the Luddites realize that they're in a bad place. Some of their fighters are hurt, and nearby British troops are probably on their way over. And the Luddites haven't even broken down the door.
So things aren't looking so good, and the Luddites retreat. They leave behind two injured men, and Cartwright's men can hear them crying.
But the mill is beat up pretty badly. No machines are broken, but you've got 8 windows on the first floor that are shot out, and 50 panes of glass are ruined on the second floor. But it's the Luddites who take the loss here. Those two wounded men, they die.
And just like that, the Luddites have lost their first battle.
It's a major blow that precedes another major blow.
A few nights later, the Luddites track down this manufacturer named William Horsfall. He's very much and very loudly anti-Luddite. So, fueled by rage from their recent losses, the Luddites kill Horsfall.
So this vicious act of revenge, it isn't a rallying cry or anything like that.
Instead of reinvigorating the Luddites, as perhaps they'd hoped, this killing incites the government. Thousands of more troops flood the countryside, and the authorities launch an intense murder investigation.
And eventually, a Luddite named William Thorpe confesses to his involvement in this wave of terrorism. He sells out a bunch of his fellow Luddites, but he saves himself from execution.
Come the next year, Britain ends up hanging 17 Luddites in connection with this crime.
Small disturbances continue for a little bit, but this deadly crackdown effectively kills the Luddite movement and the chaos that has been crawling through the countryside.
Without the Luddites there to stop them, automated machines take off across the Western world. They replace artisans. They replace the Luddites, too.
And quality of life ultimately soars. Things get better for a whole lot of people. The same tech that terrified the Luddites, well, that tech helped much of the world.
But despite their terrible, violent actions, the Luddites' underlying fears eventually come true. The Industrial Revolution brings great progress, but it also places many people in some truly despicable working conditions.
So the machines were never the biggest problem. The people were the problem. The people who used the machines and the people who fought against them.
Today in 2018, we live in a world that is very different from the world that the Luddites knew.
We've already lived through such a measurable change. Over the past 30 years, computers and the internet have entered nearly every American home. Social media, smartphones, apps, they've all just become so normal.
And here's what's really cool about that. Our favorite email providers and online stores and digital tools, you name it, they're just about entirely free.
The thing is, nothing is really free. Most people never thought much about what value these companies are getting from us, from the users. Most people didn't consider how they were paying for it.
And then the data breaches and scandals hit. There were plenty of them. Equifax, MyFitnessPal, and of course this year's Facebook and Cambridge Analytica bombshell.
The Facebook data scandal exposed the personal information of more than 87 million people. It was a really rough wake-up call for the folks who hadn't thought much about the privacy of their data.
And the truth is that data are at the heart of all of this. Data are the currency of social media and any number of other digital innovations. Data represent us, our lives, our fears, our dreams, and our quirks. Data are what's at risk.
And since the Facebook news broke, some people have been actively organizing against the use of our data in these manipulative, coercive ways. It's sort of like the return of the Luddite, but with less sledgehammering and violence.
For now, at least. Because it's very possible that these neo-Luddites will target data and analytics and AI. All the stuff that promises to make medicine stronger.
To boost treatments, improve outcomes for patients, and make value-based care a reality.
It's possible that they'll smash the machines.
And if they do, healthcare will suffer.
So it's on us, healthcare leaders, journalists, citizens, everyone, to take this conversation seriously, right now.
So to do that, on this episode of Databook, we are welcoming John Nosta. He's a big-time health tech KOL and the founder of Nosta Lab. He's a member of Google's Health Advisory Board, a writer for Forbes. He is the guy who has something to offer to this conversation.
We talked with John this week, and here's why he says it's so important not to demonize the data.
For me, the basic idea here, and this is really the key takeaway, the toothpaste is out of the tube, and you're not going to get it back in. So we live in a world that is, in essence, a data-driven world. And we enjoy it. We love it. It defines our life, everything from our smartphone to using a simple navigation like Waze. And the ownership of this data comes not only with joy, but comes with a sense of responsibility. And that responsibility is shared. So yes, Facebook is culpable. Cambridge Analytica is culpable. But I just wonder how many people took the time to read the disclosure information when they checked the box to join an app or a network. So I'm not willing to just throw my hands up or stick my head in the ground and say, oh my goodness, the world is coming to an end because Big Brother has arrived now in the form of big data. And everything is complete and total human disaster. I think it's quite the contrary. As I've said in the past, I believe that big data and all the associated aspects of it is really the third window into human civilization, into humanity. The first being the telescope, the second being the microscope. So it's important that we don't jump into this data witch hunt and establish a regressive posture where we have a false perception that we were just better in the past.
So John's been exploring the landscape and kind of seeing what's out there in the wake of the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal. What sort of opposition is cropping up? And John says that there has been quite a bit of backlash. People are deleting their Facebooks and they're trying to take their privacy into their own hands. But will it work? And how will companies respond?
It is a powerful consumer dynamic that businesses and companies are looking at with an eye on their position in the marketplace. Are they being part of this big brother, big data danger? And they have to sort of live and die by the consumer perspective, which I often think is extraordinarily reactive and ill-informed. So yes, I'm seeing a reaction from a consumer perspective, but perhaps more importantly, what I'm seeing is that there is a reactive posture on the side of companies that reflect the concern of the consumer and less the intellectual interpretive perspective that really should be driving their business. So it's an emotional situation now. And I think emotions will drive early changes, but things will settle down. As I said earlier, the toothpaste of technology and the toothpaste of big data is out of the tube. So we might change the way we squeeze it, but it's still moving in one direction, and that's out.
So it's pretty clear to John Nosta, to us, to just about everybody who's in the healthcare space, that big data and AI and all of these high-tech tools can do a lot for medicine. So when we were talking with John, we asked him, what exactly can he point to that really highlights the power of this stuff?
So there are lots of companies in the big data space. I don't think that they have been badly injured or are running for the hills. There are many, many robust participants who are leveraging data from very simple ways to extraordinarily technological ways. And some that come to mind is a company called Somatics. And what Somatics does is takes that famous thing that I like to make fun of, and that's the activity tracker, and doesn't measure steps, but measures something that is more interesting, more robust, and that's gesture. So by actually looking at the gesture of your hand and combining it with other data points like geo-navigation, they can tell you if you're eating or if you're drinking or perhaps even if you're smoking. So here's an opportunity where big data may be intrusive in the sense that it knows what sort of physical activities are doing, but it could be extraordinarily important to help people stop smoking. Another company that uses data is EarlySense. And EarlySense is looking at a variety of data sets to look at everything from ovulation detection using sensors under your bed to more sophisticated analysis of patients who are in hospital beds. So once you're out of the ICU or out of the CCU or out of a step-down unit where there's no traditional monitoring, you are at risk. And EarlySense combines interesting data points, not only heart rate, not only respiration, but actual physical movement. So we can monitor patients who are in bed and come up with prognostic information such as not only a serious physiologic condition, but also movement in the context of pressure sores.
So with all that front of mind, it really begs the question, what can healthcare do about all of this? What are the next logical steps here, and how are we going to move forward?
So I think we're seeing the standards of privacy in flux. We have to combine that with a sense of transparency, that people have to understand that when they give their data, when they have that Faustian bargain, that they are giving up something. And I believe that the appropriate disclosure will emerge. Let's go back to the early days of prescription drug advertising to consumers. In those days, it was very important for there to be fair balance. We see this in traditional pharmaceutical advertising now, that the ISI, the important safety information, is always included in an ad. Well, maybe we need a sort of fair balance context for big data, where we have a, who knows, let's call it an intrusive index or a reveal index or something where these things can be not only articulated, but standardized. And those are pretty easy. I think anybody who's been through the Facebook debacle wants to know, number one, is my data being shared? Number two, how is it being shared? And number three, can I stop that from being shared? So to me, I think that we have to teach people what's going on. And here's the key part. I think that it's not only the consumer, it's our legislators, it's our C-suite executives who often defer to those techno youngsters who understand this stuff more than I do. You can no longer default to that. I think that we have to take a greater sense of responsibility where we understand what's going on. But that means that the vendors need to articulate the areas of concern in a way that's uniform and easily understood.
So we want to get to the core of how to have productive conversations about this type of stuff. Everyone seems to be talking about it, but maybe the needle isn't moving in the direction that it should be. So we wanted to pick John's brain about how we can talk about this constructively and how we can make sure that the conversations we're having are meaningful and moving the ball forward.
Number one, as big data and analytics become more and more part of our lives, we need to be able to understand them in a practical context. So I think that some standardization of these privacy issues may go a long way to helping us put them in the context of our lives. That's number one. Number two, I believe that we often look at things as, how does this relate to humanity? How is this better for me as a human? Is Turing's law valid here? Is a chatbot as good as a human? And I think ultimately that's a big problem, because I don't think that the human intellect or even human form is any longer definitive in the context of the world we live. I think that we will see things that will transform cognition and humanity into something new, bigger, and bolder. And I've said in the past, I think the promise of technology may be to actually make us more human by changing some of the fundamental rules that we follow every day.
So it's okay to be skeptical of these new technologies, to treat them with scrutiny and to ask questions about them. It's okay to look at them with a critical eye. It's necessary to do that.
That's one of the things that makes science worth it in the end. That's one of the things that makes science progressive and moves the ball forward.
But to write off technology, to write off a means to a better end, is something we can't afford to do.
And with that in mind, that wraps up this edition of Databook.
We want to thank you so much for joining us. And again, we really do encourage you to subscribe, rate, review, tell a friend. We are having a blast putting this podcast together for you every week, and we want to make it keep happening.
We'd love to hear from you, so come visit us on hcanews.com and all of our social platforms.
And remember, if you tell us which healthcare apps that you are using and enjoying, we will put them in the August edition of our book, Healthcare Analytics News.
It's your opportunity to play a part.
Shine.
Crazy diamond.
I am Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles.
Have a good one.